Putting things off and kicking the can down the road and waiting for tomorrow, what I well know needs to be done today. We're all guilty of these things. I don't think of myself as a procrastinator, and I try to get out ahead of things, but I make a few special exceptions when it comes to procrastination. I waited once about 6 years between dentist appointments, and after that 6 years, I had a nice root canal waiting for me, and then I waited another 6 years before I went back again. Another example is that I like to wait till everybody in my entire neighborhood cuts their grass. Then I wait another week beyond that, and I finally bring out the push mower, and by that point, I pretty much need a machete to take care of what has grown up over the time. We all have ways of avoiding what we know we should be doing. We all have strategies for rationalizing it. We know we should deal with things up front, but we put it off. We often create bigger problems for ourselves by not tackling it head on at the beginning. Or sometimes we do what's required, but we cut corners. We cut corners, even though we do what we should be doing. As an example, my wife has kept for a long time a photo of me on my exercise bike, pedaling away, but with a big bag of Doritos in my left hand as I'm eating and pedaling, and that was cutting corners certainly for me. When God called the people of Israel to come into the promised land, he told them not only to go in, but to have no fear and to enter in victory. So they sent scouts out, and I think a lot of us know the story, and the report came back, there are mighty warriors in the land, and they were afraid, and a lot hesitated to actually obey and to even move forward. So God raised up Joshua, who pledged his loyalty to obey and serve the Lord, he and his house. And Joshua did have victory, and Joshua did occupy the Holy Land. But we find out that he cut some corners along the way. And as a result of cutting these corners, or incomplete obedience, things happened not immediately, but over time in the history and the life of Israel, which crippled them. And so today I'm going to explore the topic of incomplete obedience. And if we could have the next slide, we're going to go back to Deuteronomy and in chapter 9. And it says, verse 1, "Hear, O Israel, you're now about to cross the Jordan and go in and dispossess nations greater and stronger than you, with large cities that have walls up to the sky. These people are strong and tall, Anakites," which is the fancy word for Philistines, which we would know that word a bit more. "After the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, 'The Lord has brought me here to take possession of the land because of my righteousness.' No, it's on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you." Now, Joshua was challenged, as Pastor Rich has reminded us many times, "Choose this day whom you will serve." And Joshua took an oath that he would serve the Lord, he and his household. But part of that commission was not just entering into the land and enjoying victory. It was to drive out the debased and compromised Philistines that had lived there for centuries and had not repented. And Joshua knew that the time of judgment was being revealed to fall now upon the Philistines, and he was to engage them in battle. If we could have the next slide. So Joshua 11 tells us, "At that time, Joshua went up and destroyed the Anakites from the hill country, from Hebron, Debir, and Anab, from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua totally destroyed them and their towns. No Anakites or Philistines were left in Israelite territory. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive." Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive. "So Joshua took the entire land, just as the Lord had directed Moses, and he gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. Then the land had rest from war. Well, how successful was Joshua in carrying out his commission? He drove the majority of the Philistines out. He subdued all of the major strongholds. Only a few small, tiny outposts remained with an insignificant amount of population. But Joshua's obedience was incomplete. There were still warriors in the land remaining. A few pockets survived, and Israel could rest, and Israel could have a time of peace. However, there would be unforeseen consequences down the line. So again, only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod did any survive. So the first Philistine settlement, tiny, that Joshua allowed to survive was called Gaza. You may know of Gaza in current events. It's still a part of the Palestinian-Jewish conflict. It became a stronghold of evil, and Gaza would haunt the Israelites down through all Old Testament history. So for my next slide, here's the lay of the land as during the time of David now, further down the pike. You have not just Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod, but they have spread out and they've repopulated the area, and other major cities like Ekron and Ashkelon begin to metastasize. And then the next slide is unfortunately a bit of sad news here. I don't know if you can identify who's getting a haircut, who the man is here who's actually losing his hair, and you know it's Samson, right? So in Judges chapter 16, we learn about the consequences of Gaza still remaining. It says, one day Samson went down to Gaza. This is after the time of Joshua, where he saw a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. The people of Gaza were told, Samson is here. So they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, at dawn we'll kill him. Some time later, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, see if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so we may tie him up and subdue him. Each of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver. So Gaza becomes associated with lust, sexual sin, and immorality through the history of Israel moving forward. And Gaza beguiles the strongest of all the judges, the strongest man to ever live in Israel, who was Samson. And he went to Gaza to indulge in prostitution. He saw that they were plotting to subdue him, and yet he remained there. And they wanted his complete destruction. And although Samson was empowered by God and was the strongest man that Yahweh had ever given his power to, he put himself in harm's way by visiting Gaza, knowing all along what he was doing. So the result then, as we move to the next slide, we know the result, but his strength left him. And then Delilah called, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He awoke from his sleep and thought, I'll go out as before and shake myself free. He still thinks he has power, but he did not know that the Lord had left him by going repeatedly down to Gaza. Then the Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes, and took him down to Gaza, binding him with strong shackles. They set him to grinding grain in prison. So the strong man is now powerless, hopeless, in bondage, humiliated, and laid low by what had once been a tiny little pocket, a little outpost that had not been dealt with by Joshua. And they were once insignificant, now they're a major center of destructive power. So in my next slide, this is the goddess who was worshipped by the Philistines. Her name was Asherah, and they had, this is Baal's consort, a mother of 70 Canaanite gods, is according to what they believed. They had high places, the Old Testament talks about this, poles for fertility worship of Asherah, and it involved, yes, prostitution and sexual activity. What in the world is Samson doing messing around in Gaza at a place that worships a fertility goddess like this? Why is he dabbling in illicit behaviors? Well, the second Philistine settlement that Joshua did not wipe out, it was called Gath. And we could advance to our next slide. Anybody want to identify the citizen who came out of Gath? You may not know the name of the town of Gath, but you know its most famous citizen, who has a decapitated head here. This is Goliath. Goliath comes eventually out of Gath. So in 1 Samuel 17, Gath is associated with fear. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle, and they were gathered at Sakkah, which belongs to Judah. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side. Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, Goliath from Gath. He was 6 cubits and a span. I don't know how large that is, but apparently it was the largest man living at the time. So Gath is not only a major Philistine stronghold now, not a little tiny outpost, but a fortification at the time of Saul and David, but it produced the most fearsome warrior that ever blasphemed the name of Yahweh, that ever defied the armies of the God of Israel. And Goliath's name, I thought it would mean the giant or something like that, but it actually means the exposer. And we read what he's exposing. He's exposing the fear of the people of God. The troubler of Israel is an exposer of fear. So in the next slide, the story continues then. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you are servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, we'll be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, you will be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. I defy the God of Israel. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So even Saul, who was chosen by the people to be their first king because he was so strong and so impressive looking and so powerful, he is quaking in fear at the shouts of this man from Gath, the taunts of Goliath, and he blasphemes Yahweh in public. He defies the army of God, and nobody dares, not even Saul, dares to challenge Goliath, who towers over and immobilizes the people of God with fear, except for one little shepherd boy, who we know the story of how this progresses. If we could look at the next slide, the God of the Philistines, who was associated with fear, who was absolutely worshipped in Gath, was named Baal. And we know the name of Baal. They called him Baal Hadad, the vanquisher. So he vanquishes the sea, he vanquishes death, he vanquishes the serpents. He's called the Lord. That's what Baal means. He wields lightning. He's the god of storm and terror. So anyway, this false god is in the minds of the Philistines, and apparently in the minds of some of the Israelites, he's the greatest rival to Yahweh. And as he supposedly strikes fear into his enemies by deploying Goliath, it's really a contest between Yahweh and Baal is what's happening here, and Saul backs down. The final Philistine settlement that Joshua spared was called Ashdod, and this becomes associated in the Hebrew Bible with defeat. And that is Saul, who's dying as a result of the wounds from the warriors of Ashdod. And it's defeat that results from compromise. So here's our final set of scriptures. On 1 Samuel 4, we get the story of the settlement of Ashdod. So the messenger answered Eli. Eli is the spiritual leader at this time. He's one of the final judges. The messenger answers Eli and says, "Israel has fled before the Philistines. There has been a great slaughter amongst the people, and your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of the Covenant of God has been captured." The Ark of the Covenant of God has been captured. Then it happened when the mention of the Ark of God was made, Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel for 40 years. So you may remember the story, but Hophni and Phinehas were the sons of this great spiritual leader, but they were totally corrupt. They were priests through nepotism, and they kept the offerings for themselves to eat. They were immoral. They were morally compromised in many ways. They were called worthless men in the text. And their father had not rebuked them or corrected them. So these two compromised individuals who were priests thought simply by taking the Ark of the Covenant out ahead of them in battle that that would be some kind of a magical object that would just give them automatic victory. But they didn't have the presence of God. The presence of God had left the scene because of their compromises. And they were very wrong to assume that God would give them victory when they were so compromised. And then the story, a different story now. It continues on. The Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. They brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. When the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it before Dagon. And this is the third great god of the Philistines. So you actually have the Ark of the Covenant, which was meant to be the presence of the Holy God of Israel that we just sang in praise to, and it's brought before an unclean image in a pagan temple. This is what has happened now. And if I could go to the next scripture. And I mentioned how eventually Saul is killed in battle. And 1 Chronicles 10 says, "The next day when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his sons fallen on Mount Gibeon. They stripped him and took his head and his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim the good news among their idols and their people. And they put Saul's armor in the temple of their gods and hung up his head in the temple of Dagon." So because of the compromises of these two young men and the leniency of their father, the Ark of the Covenant is now lost. It's taken into the temple of Dagon. And then later, this compromised first king of Israel, Saul, who was afraid of Goliath, is killed in battle by the Philistines, and they take his head, probably on a pike, and they put it before this this image in the temple of Dagon. So the Ark and the head of the anointed one of Israel is defiled in the presence of this demonic sort of entity. So the next slide shows you Dagon, the third deity, and he was worshipped for grain and crops and harvests and fish and sustenance of all kind. What a tragedy then that the symbols of God's presence, the Ark and the King of Israel, are now offered to Dagon for worship, and it shows that the Israelites are no longer looking to Yahweh for their sustenance. And then the last in this sort of sad series of progressions, this is near the end of the Old Testament history now, in the period that leads up to the rebuilding after the exile. In Nehemiah 13, "In those days I saw Jews who married women from Ashdod and other Philistine cities. Half their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke the language of one of the peoples." So it got so bad that they were intermarrying with descendants of Ashdod, and the Israelites couldn't even speak Hebrew anymore. All the identity markers, their language. Now they're culturally Philistines, and they're culturally overwhelmed by the people of Ashdod. Well, that's not exactly the most encouraging series of scriptures to read through, so let's click to the next slide, and let's think about victory now. So in the midst of all these really difficult situations, how does the story of Samson end? Well, it is bittersweet in some ways. But at the very end of his life, when Samson is in a temple of a pagan Philistine deity, he's totally blinded, he's totally broken, he knows he's going to die here. He prays to Yahweh, "Sovereign Lord, remember me. Please strengthen me just this once." And we know what happens. He grabs the pillar, the central pillar of the altar of this Philistine god, And he literally brings the house down on all of them, destroying not only the deity, but all of the debased people that were following this was Dagon in this case. The second story, of course, Saul does not step up to the plate, but David does. And David says, who is this pagan Goliath anyway that he's allowed to defy the armies of the living God? And with his smooth stones, he takes Goliath down. And then in the temple of Dagon, where the Ark of the Covenant is, we find out as the story goes on, when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And they tried this a few more times, and each time Dagon fell and not Yahweh. So, in complete obedience of Joshua, he had promised to choose the Lord, to serve him with him in his house. He saw many victories, but his obedience was incomplete. And it had unfortunate consequences. Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod remained. So we know this. Not dealing with something that is in front of our faces today means problems are going to arise later. The weeds never grow weaker. Over time, they take over the garden. The outposts of sin, which are small, become strongholds. We know this, and yet I procrastinate pulling the moral weeds in my life. So what is it that God is calling you to confront in your life? What is it that God is calling you to confront in your life? I'm sure you knew I was going to ask this. You were probably thinking about it as I was talking. So some of us deal with fear and worry and fear of the future. Some of us may deal with lust or different forms of immorality. Probably all of us deal with compromises of different types. Most of us probably cut corners in our obedience. All of us struggle with something. All of us struggle with something. And we know from these stories, if we listen to the Spirit when he shows us that we need to deal with something, then he'll help us to pull the weed early on. Now, Joshua, Samson, and Saul were some of the strongest people in all of Old Testament history, but they did allow strongholds to flourish, and it did have detrimental results. But, as these slides of victory show here, when they called out to God for deliverance and power, he didn't abandon them, he helped them in their battles. So David literally defies fear. He defies the blasphemer of Israel. And victory was immediate in that case, but in other parts of his life, victory was not immediate. It was not overnight. But even in the darkest of all the Psalms, he says he knows God is with him, God's presence is with him in all the struggles, and that God's power is at work even when he can't detect it. He grows stronger over time. Samson literally annihilated the evil that had held him in bondage for years and years in one final act of faith before his own death, and God did not abandon Samson in defeat. So I think the takeaway for all of us is fairly straightforward. What is God's Spirit telling you right now that you need to deal with? What is God's Spirit telling you right now that you need to deal with? Let's listen to the voice. Let's obey, and let's pull the weed now and have complete obedience and not incomplete obedience.